This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 117th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have today with me Jamie Butler. Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
Jamie Butler is the CTO and chief scientist at Endgame, where he leads Endgame's research on advanced threats, vulnerabilities, and attack patterns. He's directed vulnerability research teams at a number of prominent companies, including FireEye, where he was chief architect, and Mandiant, where he was chief researcher. Jamie has over 17 years of experience in operating system security. Jamie served as a computer scientist at the NSA and co-authored Rootkits, Subverting the Windows Kernel, a book in my Addison Wesley Software Security series. Jamie has an undergrad degree from James Madison University in Virginia and an MS in computer science from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He lives with his wife, who he met at Black Hat 2005 in DuPont Circle, Washington, D.C. So thanks for joining us today, Jamie.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you've been at Endgame just a short while, about 9 months, you said, working for Silver Bullet victim and good friend of mine, Nate Fick.
Yeah, that's correct.
What do you do as CTO of Endgame?
Yeah, so I started back in March, and I was kind of charged with building out their research team. So they had a lot of research in the past, but it wasn't a clear business unit, and so we wanted to make sure that that was on track with the company. So we formed the R&D team here, and so that started. We transferred a few people in internally that were already existing within the company, and then we hired about 11 people.
So you have a bunch of people reporting to you, I guess.
Yeah, I did manage to hire one senior director came over from an existing team, and then I hired another director who out of the NSA, who basically over our malware research and threat intelligence. And then I'm still looking for someone to lead up our data science effort.
What are your responsibilities as CTO? It's kind of a funny title. I know I've had it for 20 years, and people do different things when they have that title.
Yeah, I think every company is a little bit different with their CTO. Some are more evangelists, some are more, you know, kind of, sometimes the CEO becomes the CTO after he founds the company and gets some traction. For me, it's really, the chief scientist part is really about the internal research and building detection into our product suite.
Uh-huh.
But the CTO is more of the outward facing, you know, talking to, you know, investors, talking to the press and things like that.
So managing the brand and being the, I always call it the hood ornament of the corporation.
Yeah. I mean, I still have real functions as the chief scientist, but it's a lot of outward focusing things.
What do you mean real functions? Come on, Jamie.
I'm a coder at heart, so I can never get rid of my coding job to some degree. I like to take it with me wherever I go.
Well, that makes sense.
Recently, you know, I told the CEO, Nate, that I was writing some code for our endpoint product, and he kind of rolled his eyes. He's like, I'm not sure you should be doing that. I'm like, well, I'm not sure I should be either, but it's what keeps me happy.
Yeah. Oh, he'll let you do it. He's a good leader.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
In its first iteration, Endgame was all about offense, and in my recollection, sort of played a role in this idea of active defense in the private sector. Has that changed?
Yeah, I can, you know, I haven't been here that long, but I can speak to what I know about the company's past.
Yeah.
They did start with an offensive mentality to help the government in, you know, various areas, and particularly it's been well publicized that kind of in the vulnerability exploit type of thing. I don't think that they were ever for the I don't think they ever espoused the kind of hack back or active defense, if you consider it that way.
Yeah.
But only you know, only at the federal level do they have the correct permissions, you know, or legal authorities to do something like that.
Well, it was all kind of bound up together with the CrowdStrike guys, and you know, there were a few startups that were kind of talking up a big game in terms of this notion of attacking back. But what are your thoughts about that, by the way, just as a philosophy? Do you think that the private sector should be allowed to do that?
I don't think. I think it's really difficult, the attribution piece of it. And, you know, in the meantime, if you don't get the attribution right, or maybe even if you get the attribution right, but they're using jump points or whatever else, like, you're actually victimizing, you know, potentially innocent, you know, bystanders in the process.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't espouse the hackback, and I think Nate's pretty firm on that as well with our company.
Yeah, I know he's pretty firm on that himself philosophically. I mean, yeah. You know, one kind of way of waging war is to get your enemy to attack your other enemy and watch them have a fight.
Yeah.
And there's no reason that sort of thing can't happen in cyberspace as well. So, like you, I believe we haven't solved the attribution problem very well, and especially when it comes to short time periods. If you want to, you know, do something right now to whoever's attacking you, figuring out who that is sometimes takes months to figure out. So you believe we haven't solved the attribution problem either?
Yeah, that's correct.
Of course, there are great offense ideas like rootkits and attack patterns that you've been working on for many years that
right.
play a really important role in security engineering too.
Right.
Do you think that we've made progress in trying to adopt some of the thinking and of the ideas from the attacker community and use that to inform our engineering, or what's your feeling about that?
I think we're still a little bit early there. That's what we espouse here at Endgame, is really taking that offensive mentality, like how the attacker thinks and works, and mm-hmm. using that against them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're, like, I'm building kernel-level capabilities within, you know, our product suite and so forth. So I believe, you know, you need to be like have a very offensive mindset. We've hired a lot of people out of, you know, different government organizations who have the authorities to do hacking and so forth. And so I believe that we're uniquely positioned to really deliver that capability to the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But I think the only place I think maybe the industry's getting it kind of right is the exploit prevention side. There's a lot of that going on right now. And even the larger companies like Microsoft and so forth are building it, you know, kind of into their products.
Yeah, and with like address space randomization on the stack and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are good ideas, and they are informed by attack patterns. But I'll tell you what, you know, we have this thing called the BSIM, and the weakest of all of the 12 practices that we keep track of is attack patterns. So I think we have more work to do to get people that do security engineering to really understand and comprehend and appreciate the attacker perspective.
Yeah, I was talking to someone the other day, and I said, you know, basically, I come from an endpoint world, operating system, you know, centric, and I think we spent the last decade in building products that can create a lot of data.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to get data off an endpoint, you know, there's products out there that will do it, but they don't have really any intelligence built into them, and so you have to have an expert really use those tools to make them useful.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that attackers' patterns and, you know, kind of how they operate and what their motivations are and so forth are important to build into the product, the capability to detect those things.
Yeah, I agree with that, and the only way to know that is to study it. Talk about it and write about it. You know that I wrote Exploiting Software a million years ago with Greg Hoglund, who was your co-author of the Rootkits book. That was a great book, by the way.
Thank you.
And we first wrote about rootkit stuff in Chapter 9 of Exploiting Software, and we sort of figured we'd get a lot of flack for that, but we got less flack than we expected, because I think everybody understands you need to know the attacker perspective in order to do what we're all trying to do.
Yeah, I think I had some of your very early books on Java security and so forth, and I had the Exploiting Software book before I ever met you through Greg.
Yeah.
But when Greg and I put, we had to do like a sample chapter and kind of the introductory and the outline for the book company, the publisher, Addison Wesley, and we put it out there, and of course they shop it around to some other experts in the field.
Yeah.
And the experts kind of give their kind of thumbs up, thumbs down. Do you think this is a good idea?
Yeah.
And some, like if I said these people's names, like you know who they were.
I can guess.
I won't do that. But they basically said, why in the world would you want to publish a book like this? And so it was kind of tough at first getting the contract and so forth. Because a lot of people just want to, you know, they think that you're helping the enemy or whatever. I kind of come from the world where you had to do proof of concept in order to get vendors to change their security.
Yeah, so you have to show them what that means.
Yeah, the like the FU rootkit that I wrote back in 2003, that was, you know, just to show basically Microsoft that this was possible to hide these processes in the kernel without anything wrong happening.
Right, right. You can just be very, very stealthy and they don't even see you.
Yeah, and it took, I want to say it was like 4 or 5 years to patch, maybe even longer, because basically their solution to it was in Windows, I forget what the first incarnation of PatchGuard was, if that was Windows 7, 64.
I think it was 7, yeah.
Yeah, so it was actually, I think, 7 years to come out, patch, but PatchGuard was the first thing that defeated it.
Well, you remember that, you know, hooking system calls way early on in NT, heck, that worked before the FU rootkit came out for many years as well.
Yeah.
There was sort of one byte hack to NT.
Yeah, people go look for, you know, patches to those system calls, and Greg and I released on Tech TV back in the day, I think it was maybe 2004, it must have been 2005, we released Vice that would basically go around and catch the hookers. it would look for people patching your system call table and other things like that.
You and Greg always had the most clever little names for your stuff.
Yeah. But it was funny. We went on live television and gave this 6-minute presentation, and it was somewhat, you know, to promote the book and so forth. But we wanted to release something useful for the audience.
Yeah.
And this was a very general audience. It wasn't a security audience. So, like, we came back and there was like 83,000 downloads or something of the tool on rootkit.com.
Wow.
That Greg founded, and I helped administer some, and. Yeah, it was crazy, and people writing in like, hey, these are the hooks I'm finding, because Microsoft actually hooks themselves.
Yeah, I know.
And so it's,
Microsoft
it's
Research built the whole Detours thing with hooking.
Yeah, exactly, and now they sell the Detours for 64-bit. But so we had these, you know, mom and pops like emailing in to rootkit.com and saying that they're detecting these hooks, and they wanted to know if they're bad or good, and it was a mess. Like,
careful what you ask for. I remember when I did Tech TV the first time, I think it might even have been with Greg, or maybe now it was with Viega before that. But the amount of web traffic you get with television is astounding. You know, TV, I guess it's become more distributed, but TV is still a very powerful medium indeed.
Right.
So tell us about operating system security. So when you started with your rootkit work, you know, at least there was a kernel, but it was early days of kernel land, and things have changed a lot in operating system security, I think for the better. Do you agree?
Yeah, they've definitely advanced a lot. I think actually Windows has advanced the most. I'm not a Linux expert by any means, but, you know, some of the old tricks that you could do on Windows, you can still do on a lot of the Windows or Linux boxes. So I'm really impressed by the amount of, you know, research and also, you know, the amount of, like, just investment that Microsoft's put into their operating system. And, like, they've hired, you know, some great people in the security industry and things like that.
Yep. Well, I think they really took software security seriously and integrated it not just into operating system stuff, but also into their other products too. So that's good. That means we're making some forward progress, I guess. Even though sometimes when you look back, you wonder how little forward progress it is. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. I know you guys are using machine learning stuff at Endgame, and I don't know if you know this, but I actually have a PhD in that nonsense from years and years ago. So I'm really interested to know what kind of machine learning you're using and what you've learned about that yourself.
Yeah, I'm definitely not the expert in that. I can talk myself into a corner probably, but we have two different types of machine learning that we're using. We're doing some malware classification right now and clustering, and we're using some supervised machine learning for that.
Uh-huh.
We think potentially we might enter semi-supervised machine learning on that because we want to try to trick our models and so forth and get user feedback and, like, is this truly good or bad?
Are you using neural networks? Are you using genetic algorithms? Are you using symbolic machine learning? What kind of, do you know?
I know we're not using genetic. I'm not sure about the other classes that you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, supervised versus unsupervised is an important distinction, so that gives us some idea. So that's something that's pretty new. I bet that's pretty fun to be learning about.
Yeah, we have a good-sized team here with a lot of good experience. We have someone that we've, you know, hired out of, like, national labs and things like that. Others that come from different computer security companies and a few even from kind of politics and things like that. So it's an interesting, diverse group of people.
Yeah, I think that we're going to see a lot more machine learning in computer security because of speed issues and classification issues. The machine can do stuff faster, not always more accurately, but certainly faster than humans. And this notion that there are people sitting around in a sock watching the internet go by is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, we're also, in addition to kind of some of the malware work that we're doing, we're also working on just behavioral analysis of the host itself and how that host is related to other hosts in the environment and kind of what's going on there. And then we're just starting to look at user behavior as well. So, like, kind of a pattern of life for that user and seeing deviations away from that.
Yeah, there's a big body of work about that. You have to watch out for this one little sneaky attack that involves changing the user profile really slowly over time.
Right.
So you get into attack space and then you carry out your attack and then you very slowly change your profile way back to normal, which was actually seen in a national lab once.
Wow. Yeah.
That was trying to use, you know, anomaly detection stuff. But that's all good stuff. Are you still active on the rootkits.com thing with Greg or is that done?
That's done. It was hacked a few years back.
After the H.P. Gary thing?
Yeah, with the H.P. Gary thing. And so it hasn't been put back online as far as I'm aware.
Right.
I think Greg still owns the domain and everything. And we've chatted a few times about bringing it back up, but, you know, it's...
served its purpose.
Yeah, it served its purpose. I think the time has passed. When we had it up, one of the problems we always had, and Greg was always frustrated by this and trying to figure out how to make it better, was just the amount of contributors was pretty low.
Yeah.
Like, we had 80 or 90,000 users. Now, not all of those were, like, actually real users because we had no way to reset your password.
Right.
So people would just create a new account. So anyway, we had a lot of users, and there was literally, like, a handful, maybe two handfuls of people that contributed on the site.
Right.
So that was always an issue, getting new and fresh content.
Listen, man, I saw that in the early days of static analysis tools for code review as well. You know, we released this tool, it's for like in 1999, and it got downloaded 15,000 times in the first month, and then even more during the first year. And we asked people to please contribute rules to the rule set. Guess how many rules we got over the first year?
10.
Zero.
Really? Wow.
None.
Yeah.
In fact, I had to force my own guys at gunpoint to make rules because it was such a pain. So I think this notion that, you know, everybody's going to crowdsource security is pretty darn silly.
Yeah. When rootkit.com, everything was open source, and we had, like, I had one person reach out to me, very smart lady from the UK, with a bug in the rootkit. Like, it was actually blue screening her system. And she could point out where it was, but she couldn't tell me, like, what was causing it. And so that was, it was still good feedback that there was a problem there, and so that was nice. But really, there wasn't a lot of other contribution that came out of it. We used to joke that probably, like, 60% of our users were actually the AV industry.
trying to figure out how to detect stuff.
Yeah, they did troll that pretty hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember the HB Gary hack, too, because all of my mail to Greg and Penny showed up on a Russian server. So I went to search to see what I'd told them. And actually, there was one mail I'm sort of proud of, so I have to tell you about it, where Greg had asked me for somebody's cell phone number, and I said, I can't send that to you on this channel. And when I read that on a Russian server, I was just like, yes.
That's good, awesome.
Good OPSEC. But it's a little weird to go read your email on somebody else's server later.
Yeah, I was mentioned a few times in those emails, I think.
Yep, I remember.
Greg and I were having some differences of opinion on some things.
I never used that channel for anything important.
It was funny because I was told not to read it by our CEO at the time when I was working at Mandiant.
Right.
And then I didn't read it. And then I walked into the restaurant like a day or two after it happened, when it was all leaked on the internet. And the people there like got up from the table. I was meeting a bunch of security people, right?
Yeah.
And so they get up from the table and then they called me what Greg had called me. He didn't call me to my face. He told like Petty and Bob and other people that I was this thing, and so they all get up and yell that at me, and I just like look at them like, what?
Oh, that is hilarious, man.
And they're like, you haven't read the emails? And I'm like, no, I'm not allowed to. And they're like, oh, this is what Greg said. But we've hugged and made up since then.
Oh, Greg's a great guy. It's hard to stay mad at him for too long.
Yeah, I don't take anything personal.
So let's see. You started your career at the NSA before moving on to Mandiant, HP Gary, FireEye, and all that stuff. Can you compare and contrast those worlds? Is it just like utterly different? I mean, HP Gary versus Mandiant must be pretty different too, really.
Yeah, I mean, I was you know, brand new to computer security when I was hired at the NSA. They had a great program called SNIP at the time where it kind of is an incentive because you weren't really making like commercial dollars, but kind of to compensate for that, they have great training, and they would actually, this year that I joined up in 97, they would pay for your master's degree.
Right.
Or at least a full year to go get your master's. And so that was a great program, and that's when I went to UMBC and got my master's in computer science.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. IAD, the Information Assurance Directorate, was, you know, responsible for securing the government's computers.
Sure. That's where the common criteria stuff lives.
Right, right. The hard part, though, for me at the end of the day was they really didn't have any authority over any of the government institutions that they were asked to help.
Right.
So, you know, like, they couldn't evaluate like NASA's systems or even DOD systems unless they were invited. And even if they were invited, they couldn't mandate like that the you know, patches were in place or don't use this software because it's got all these vulnerabilities or anything like that.
Yeah, so you know what, Jamie, it's actually gotten even worse after the Snowden stuff because, you know, now people are even less trusting of the NSA and they don't want them to help the rest of the government, ironically.
Right.
So it was bad and now it's worse. I was just talking to some NSA guys last week and, you know, we were talking with a guy from Homeland Security who said, well, we sure could use some help, but last time we tried to get some help, we got in big trouble, and it was, rejected from the body pretty much. So interesting stuff.
Then the last 3 years I was there, I was in SIGINT, and that was a lot of fun. Like, I really worked with some brilliant people in my time there. You know, was always learning new things. I was still fairly young to the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of felt more of a sense of purpose because, you know, you were trying to actually fight terrorism and different spies and things like that. And that was intriguing. I really liked that part. But at the end of the day, after 5 years, I kind of got a little bit burned out on it. Mm-hmm. And decided I needed to go try something in the commercial sector. And so I decided to leave. But it's a place, like, I believe, you know, when college kids come up to me or even high school and be like, hey, you know, I'm thinking about the career in cybersecurity. Like, what do you think I should do and where should I work? And, you know, I got this offer maybe from the NSA or whatnot. And, you know, I always encourage them, like, if they're not a specialist yet, don't know exactly what they want to do. You know, the NSA is a great training ground, and they invest a lot in their people,
mm-hmm.
Or at least they did when I was there. And so I usually encourage them, like, to try that road. It's not a bad road to go.
Mm-hmm. And then you worked for Mandiant for 7 years, which is a long time before it was bought by FireEye.
Yeah, exactly. So I had been CTO at a small startup between HP Gary and Mandiant. And
Kumoko, is that right?
Yeah, Komoku. And they were going in a different way than kind of what I'd originally signed up to do. And so I talked to the CEO and I decided to leave after about 8 months or so. And so I was unemployed. I was getting married in 4 months, had a honeymoon to pay for and a ring to pay for and all that stuff. And so I didn't have anything to go to. And so I was talking to a few companies in California, but everyone wanted me to move to California. I'm kind of an East Coast guy, or I have been my whole life.
Heck yeah, man. Go for it. Me too.
And I was like, you know, I don't, like, I, you, you know, we have the internet and a few things like that today. Like, you can do this remotely, or, you know, y'all have some offices over here on the East Coast. I could, you know, go to one of those or something. And they were like, no, we you know, really don't want you to work remotely.
We try to keep our researchers in a special room, they would say.
Yeah, one of the companies I was talking to had recently, at that time, had their source code stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were obviously really concerned about any remote connection to the office.
I remember that story. That was hilarious. Yeah. And the silly thing was that you could reverse the dang thing anyway. So that having the source code out was not that big of a deal.
Yeah. So I was introduced to Mandiant by an employee who used to work for my wife.
Hmm.
And he's like, hey, you should come interview at Mandiant. And I was like, you know, I've never heard of y'all. And
you didn't know Kevin, huh? That's interesting.
I didn't know Kevin, even though he was Air Force and DOD and that kind of thing in the past. I didn't know him at the time because this was like 2006, and he wasn't extremely vocal back then.
Well, he was running around doing lots of tutorials and stuff. He'd been doing that for several years. He was very good at
Foundstone and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was like, well, you know, the guy invited me to dinner with Kevin and with the VP of engineering, Dave Merkel.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, yeah, I'm unemployed. I'll go to dinner with you. You're buying, right? And he's like, yeah. So
you got any good tickets to Hawaii for me?
So I went to dinner with them, and they gave me kind of a David and Goliath story. They were this small startup, and they were kind of trying to take on the incumbent and things like that.
Yeah.
And I really, that drew me to what they, you know, to the company and what they're trying. And so they wanted a Windows endpoint, and I'm like, yeah, I kind of know a few things about that.
Yep.
So yeah, I started there.
That was a heck of a ride, man. That thing went out for $1 billion. Craziness.
Yeah, it was nuts. I'm very fortunate that it worked out the way it did.
Yeah. So when you joined, it was probably still pretty little and then grew really fast as heck.
Yeah. I think we were about 26 or 27 people when I joined. And I remember like maybe the first year, I think our revenue was like under even 5 million. It was like really small.
And then at the end it was a big company, and then it got bought by an even bigger company. And now we're not sure what's left.
Yeah, we were about 500 people when we were acquired.
Yeah.
We just like 2 years early had taken on $70 million of funding.
Yep.
From a few VCs in the Valley. So we'd exploded from going from like maybe 3 years earlier from 150 or so to jacking up to 300 and then, you know, finally to 500.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you managed a bunch of researchers there, I guess, what, 19 people, something like that. What's that like? I mean, do you like managing people? We sort of talked about that at the top, but researchers, I'm using that term in the hacker boy sense and not in the science sense, I must say to my listeners. Researchers are interesting people, to say the least. So, you know, managing them is, I don't know. How'd that go?
Yeah, it went pretty well. There was a few odd things that happened here and there that I can't go into, but I...
Oh, come on.
I think the... well,
it's only 10,000 okay, people going to hear this.
Well, I did have an employee. These two employees worked at a remote office, and one of them called me up and he said, "Hey, I almost got in a fight, you know, in the parking lot with this other employee." And, you know, I challenged, like, these two were kind of at each other's throats a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And so the older gentleman told the younger guy, who actually had a black belt, I think, in karate, that he wanted to go to the parking lot to fight.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my gosh, like, they're telling me this over the phone, like, individually, like, on our one-on-ones. And I'm like, no, you realize, like, you can't do this. And actually, I should, like, do the responsible thing and take this to HR, but then it's going to go in your record, and it's going to be a big mess. And I was just like, just chill out. Don't threaten to fight anybody anymore.
That's
like,
funny.
Y'all two need to sit down with me. And we need to air the grievances and, like, talk face-to-face as gentlemen and get this behind us.
You're such a Southern boy.
Yeah.
Harrisonburg's coming through, man.
Yeah. So that was one of the biggest things I think happened while I was there. But normally it goes well. I think that I consider, you know, myself just like a researcher, coder, just like the people that work for me. So it's a lot of camaraderie and...
Yeah.
You know, I think you set the right vision and you get hard goals and you work, you work as much as anyone working for you does or maybe more, and you set the right example and it goes pretty well.
Yep. I think that's very good advice. I got one last question for you. So do you think a track on security engineering would be useful at Black Hat? I know you're on the committee over there.
Yeah, I think it would. We have one that not many people submit to. I think it's been called out once or twice in the call for papers. It's kind of a software engineering track that covers security issues, you know, and coding and things like that.
Yeah, that was the thing that ShowStack tried to get booted.
Yeah. So we have that, but we don't get any submissions to it, really.
Huh.
I think maybe we had one that could kind of qualify for that, maybe the Asia show that's coming up.
Right.
I don't remember if it was selected or not. We're kind of still in the process of that.
Yeah. I think if you made a big deal out of that somehow, that would be great. But, you know how I feel about building stuff. I think that's our only solution here. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck on an endless hamster wheel of pain.
Yeah, and we have so many, you know, like, new people coming into the field every day, you know. There's these incubators out there that, you know, kind of take someone for 3 months, and they've never written code before, and at the end of the 3 months, you know, they're actually in the state that they're good enough, you can hire them for your company, and, you know, we've done that here at Endgame, and I'm not sure about previous places I worked, but, you know, they don't inherit that kind of heritage from from secure coding and all these other things that's happened over the last decade or so.
No doubt. Plus, things are evolving so quickly with dynamic languages and all the web crap, you know.
Oh, yeah, you can't keep up with it all.
You have to in security engineering. That's the challenge. So last thing from total left field, I know that you're into humanitarian causes. What's your favorite one or the one that you're most interested in now?
So I follow Hackers for Charity and support them. Johnny, you know, he's moved his family and everything to Africa, and he's trying to help the local people, train them so that they can be self-sufficient and, you know, do computer-type work and so forth. Mm-hmm. I think I just look at that as, like, an incredible example. Like, I can't imagine, you know, giving up my house and my car and, you know, we don't have kids, but, you know, his kids are, you know, we're going to school in Africa and so forth. That's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. And pretty selfless of him. So I really like that. Locally, I, you know, support a charity called IJM, International Justice Mission,
mm-hmm.
and they fight human slavery and kind of sex trafficking all around the world. And so that's a good thing I like.
Cool. Well, good on you. It was great talking to you, Jamie. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the time.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October 2015 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is devoted to the economics of cybersecurity. The issue also features our interview with European cryptographer Bart Pernille. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.